Welcome to Science Questions. This is Sherry Quinn. Great apes, humans' closest relatives, are nearing extinction. There are four kinds: gorillas, chimpanzees, and bonobos that live in Africa, and orangutans that subsist in Indonesia. Primatologist Craig Stanford says they all may become extinct within the next century.
Their total population, if you combine the remaining numbers of all four species, is only in the low hundreds of thousands. And so compared to 7 billion of us on the planet, that's a very scary low number. And a couple of those species, in particular, the bonobo and the orangutan, are really perilously close to the brink of extinction. And that's why I thought we needed to get the information out there to the public about exactly what's going on with them in terms of their extinction risk, and also what efforts are being made to protect them.
Craig Stanford is professor of biological sciences and anthropology at the University of Southern California, where he also serves as co-director of the Jane Goodall Research Center. He has conducted numerous field studies throughout the world, including chimpanzee hunting behavior in Tanzania, in collaboration with Dr. Jane Goodall, of chimpanzees and mountain gorillas in Uganda, and of langur monkeys in South Asia. In addition, for the past several years, he has been involved in field research and conservation efforts on endangered tortoises. In fact, SQ Radio aired an interview with Stanford about his book titled The Last Tortoise in 2010. He feels especially partial to wild chimpanzees, and one in particular.
I feel incredibly privileged that I've been able to spend as much time as I have in forests in Africa and Asia, sitting in close company with wild animals, and in particular, wild chimpanzees in East Africa. And, you know, I've worked with a lot of wild chimps in terms of, is there an individual who strikes a chord with me? One of Jane Goodall's most famous chimps is a huge male named Frodo, who is a member of a famous long lineage of chimps that were descended from Flo, one of her original female chimps back in the 1960s. And Frodo is a big, macho male chimp who was a great hunter of monkeys, and I was studying monkey hunting back in the 90s. So I spent a lot of time with him. He was kind of fearsome, kind of neurotic, a little bit scary to be around sometimes, but a magnificent, brilliant, Machiavellian sort of animal. And I think to be in the close company of an animal like that, particularly in the wild, you know, in an African forest, where you can approach them and be accepted into their day-to-day life, is just an almost unspeakably wonderful privilege I feel I've gotten to enjoy in my life. And so you can't help but then want to give something back when you've had that experience.
Stanford has published 16 books and more than 100 scholarly and popular articles. He says most of the books he's written have been about the science of primate behavior and using what great apes do to understand human nature and human origins.
And after many years of doing research on that topic and writing many books and many articles, I decided I would write a book that was completely explicitly about conservation in order to try to raise consciousness, raise awareness of some of the really critical issues facing the remaining great apes.
His latest book, Planet Without Apes, is the story of a tragic extinction that Stanford urges us to stop. Of the four living great apes, orangutans are the most threatened to leave this earth first.
Well, each species has its own set of problems. But in general, if you looked at orangutans, which live in Southeast Asia, in Indonesia, on the islands of Sumatra and Borneo, their biggest threat is deforestation. So the Indonesian government is in charge of a rapidly developing economy, and a lot of that economy revolves around exploiting the natural resources. That's understandable, but there's very little room left in their plan for development for the wildlife of Indonesia, and it's a very wildlife-rich country. So just rapid, large-scale clearing of the forest in order to create palm plantations to grow oil palms have just absolutely ravaged orangutan populations. There are some estimates that the orangutan population has dropped by 20 or 30% just in the last 6 or 8 years, so it's really in free fall.
The extinction risks to the great apes in Africa, the bonobo, chimpanzee, and gorilla, are different depending on where you look, but there are some commonalities.
One of the big threats facing African apes is the fact that people in Africa, in some parts of Africa, absolutely relish the meat of great apes. They treat the meat of great apes as a delicacy. They regard them in the same way that we regard lobster or caviar, and they're willing to pay, people who can afford to are willing to pay 5 or 10 times the price of beef to get a meal of smoked gorilla hams or chimp feet. And usually this is a meal that's used to impress your colleagues, your house guests, but is absolutely ravaging African ape populations. It's gone on for thousands of years. The eating of apes is something that people have done in Africa as a tradition for thousands of years, we think. And it probably never had a severe impact until recently, because recently it's become a commercialized industry with smuggling routes out of the African forest to go to towns, cities, and even ultimately on a global black market scale to Europe and perhaps even North America.
Another threat is the black market for bushmeat. It ends up in some of the world's most famous cities.
The scale of bushmeat smuggling globally is absolutely mind-boggling. And to be honest, great apes only represent a tiny slice of the overall bushmeat trade, the illegal trade. Most of it is the meat of antelopes, pigs, and assorted other African animals. But the problem the great apes have is that they reproduce very, very slowly. So their numbers just simply cannot sustain themselves. They can't even begin to sustain themselves in the face of this really highly developed, commercialized trade for bushmeat. And yes, Charles de Gaulle Airport in Paris has had a smuggling bus, and the estimates are that maybe tens of tons of bushmeat are being smuggled through Charles de Gaulle Airport every year, and there have been busts in Brussels, London, basically any place where West and Central African people have migrated to and formed expat communities, there is a demand for bushmeat because it is culturally valued. And so there'll be restaurants and cafes that are illegally selling this meat out of a back room, and that drives the demand.
Stanford has worked in a lot of national parks in Africa that are safe havens for apes. But he adds it is important to look at them more closely before trusting they are legitimate.
Sometimes, depending on which one, they're well protected. They have, you know, armed guards. They have conservation programs with public outreach. They have tourist programs that are thriving. But many, many national parks in Africa or anywhere in the developing world often exist in name only. So if you opened an atlas and looked on a map of some countries, you'd see all of these big national parks indicated, sometimes hundreds of square miles. But very often, they're only on the map. If you actually go to that place, there are no fences, there are no guards, there's no entry point, and there simply is wanton, open poaching of wild animals and illegal cutting of the trees, simply because the governments involved just don't have the resources to create an infrastructure to protect these places, and they don't have an infrastructure that would support the tourist industry either.
According to Stanford, one of the biggest threats to protecting wildlife and natural ecosystems everywhere is political instability.
I mean, that's why the affluent democracies of the world, the European countries and North America and Australia, have the best national park system. Because in unstable places, those tend to be poor places. And as we know, civil wars and ethnic cleansing and genocide and a lot of awful stuff tends to happen, you know, almost entirely in the modern world in desperately poor places. And so in these desperately poor places, it's hard to set up and maintain a conservation program. It's hard to even know what's going on. And so many of these civil war-torn areas in Africa are kind of no man's land, where scientists cannot go safely, conservationists cannot go and do surveys safely, and then, of course, you can't set up a project that tourists are going to want to go to in the face of political instability.
In his field research in Africa, Asia, and Central and South America, Stanford has worked amidst political turmoil.
In the areas where I've worked primarily in my career, primarily East Africa, thankfully there is no real bushmeat trade. People don't really eat the meat of primates, monkeys or apes in those areas. It's mainly Western and Central Africa where that happens. However, Uganda, where I had a project for 10 years, has pockets of instability, and my own project was in the middle of a rebel militia attack in the late 90s that resulted in the kidnapping of a number of foreign tourists, eco-tourists who had gone to see the gorillas. Some of those tourists were murdered by the rebels. And when you set up an ecotourism program and you use the revenue from it to support conservation and protection of animals like gorillas, that's a great plan. But if you're in a politically chaotic area, the minute there's an attack like this, of course, the whole thing falls apart. So for about a year, tourism just ended, and tourism is providing the economic incentive for local people to respect and protect the wildlife. So, yeah, there was kind of a wild ride there in some of the places that I've done my research.
American zoologist Diane Fossey became well known for her story told in the book Gorillas in the Mist that was later made into a film. She studied guerrilla groups in Rwanda for 18 years and was mysteriously murdered in 1985. Stanford describes her influence in the study of guerrillas, and he reveals surprising details about Fozzie's field strategies.
She really broke new ground in immersing herself in the lives of mountain guerrillas and showing the world that they were, in fact, gentle creatures whose main threat was from people and not the other way around. But at the same time, Diane Fossey was a kind of a troubled person, and she regarded her camp in Rwanda as her own kingdom, in a sense. And so, in fact, for many years, she ruled that area and protected it against poachers, mainly with the threat of a shotgun, shooting at poachers and acting like an armed guard. And in the end, that backfired in a big way. It didn't really stop the guerrilla poaching. She eventually was murdered, we think, by an ex-employee or maybe a poacher. And then, ironically, immediately after her death, her former students approached the government of Rwanda, and they proposed a new path, which would involve tourism. Fossey had always ardently opposed ecotourists coming into her forest. The tourists would come, and the plan was they would pay money to see the gorillas, and a portion of that money would go toward national park conservation projects. And today, if you go to Diane Fossey's former forest station and her field project, you have one of the best-run and most successful ecotourism programs involving big animals anywhere in the world. And that money from that program is really helping give the government of Rwanda a true incentive now to protect mountain gorillas.
An unlikely culprit nearly all of us in America use every day is contributing to the decline of a population of gorillas in the Congo, Stanford explains.
Very few people realize that when they pull out their smartphone, they're using a device that contains a kind of an ore called coltan, which is a nickname for an ore called columbite tantalite. That is, it's an essential part of your iPhone or your smartphone because it allows these miniature devices to run without overheating. But at the same time, this ore mostly comes from forests in the Congo, the Democratic Republic of Congo, in which the last remaining populations of eastern lowland gorillas live. And about 80% of the world's coltan supply comes from that place. And so there is a major mining operation in those areas. It's sort of similar to the California Gold Rush in that it is a very destructive kind of mining that really devastates river streams and the forests surrounding them. The miners establish themselves in camps, and they end up hunting the gorillas for food while they're there. So it's had a devastating effect on eastern lowland gorilla populations, which have now dropped to just a few thousand. We really don't know for sure. So ironically, this high-tech product, which is mined in the Congo, then shipped to China, and then ends up in everybody's smartphone, is having a big impact back in the Congo on wild gorilla populations.
Tragic. I mean, here I'm on my cell phone, and you are too.
Right. There is no easy solution. Of course, we tell people to recycle their cell phones when they're done with them and not just toss them away. That maybe makes a dent in this problem. But, of course, it's a major problem given the popularity and the increasing use of these miniaturized devices throughout the world.
Another threat to the great apes are emerging viruses.
A lot of those diseases that Hollywood likes to turn into blockbuster movies like Ebola or anthrax, and which we think of some of them as being bioterror weapons or just, you know, scary, almost science fiction diseases, actually probably have had a much greater impact on great apes than they've ever had on humans. So we know that in the Republic of the Congo, there have been thousands of gorilla deaths and probably chimp deaths too, where carcasses have been found scattered across the rainforest floor, and they have been victims of Ebola. We don't really even know precisely the whole system of how Ebola works in terms of who all the vectors are, which animals are carriers, and what animals they pass it to. But we know that Ebola has been responsible for thousands of great ape deaths. Some estimates say as high as 5 to 10% of all the remaining gorillas in Africa have died over the past 10 or 15 years from Ebola. So that's just, another. I know that these threats pile up and it seems like an insurmountable problem. I don't think it is insurmountable. I think we're passing through a bottleneck right now, and we need to get these animals and their habitats through the bottleneck. And hopefully by the mid to late 21st century, the populations will be in better shape, the world population will stabilize, and we'll have a better chance to preserve them long term.
In the 1950s, wild chimpanzees were brought to the U.S. for behavioral and biological testing. Even though we have since learned the genetic codes of chimps and humans are 99% similar, we still use them as guinea pigs.
I would like to be able to say that there is no research being done anywhere in the world on captive great apes because they are so similar to us that it just seems unthinkable we'd be using them as medical pincushions. There are about 1,500 chimpanzees in laboratories in the United States, biomedical facilities, and there are plans afoot to phase them out of research completely. Right now, there are relatively few being used actively in biomedical research. There are many that have been infected with diseases in the past, everything from HIV to hepatitis B, which they're never going to get rid of, and so they don't make ideal candidates to be placed in zoos or other kinds of facilities. But there are countries outside of the U.S. That continue to use great apes in biomedical research, and of course, those of us who work with great apes, I think that's an immoral thing to do.
Then there are the stories of them as pets. Stanford points one out in the book that ended in misfortune for both the chimp and the couple who brought him into their home.
There's a long history, of course, of people keeping great apes as pets. I mean, in the old days, 50 years ago, it was legal to buy a chimpanzee from an animal dealer and raise it as your child in your home in America. And, of course, if you do that, you end up with a severely dysfunctional full-grown ape at some point, especially if we're talking about a male chimp who outgrows his home. He begins to become destructive. He just doesn't control his impulses very well. And in general, it's a bad scene for everyone. Of course, we've all seen these tragedies in recent years. The woman in Connecticut who was attacked by a pet chimpanzee. You know, just a bad idea to have any wild animal being kept in your home as a pet and thinking that that animal is no longer wild. In the case of great apes, it's doubly tragic because the animals themselves are highly intelligent, psychologically very needy, emotionally needy creatures that are really a person in a household cannot possibly care for, no matter how much they think they might be able to. It's largely illegal to obtain a baby ape today in the United States. There are cases. There's a case going on in Las Vegas right now where someone wants to have, I think, not one but multiple pet chimps. But in general, it's much more difficult to do that than it ever has been. But, you know, there are many ethical questions being raised, even about whether chimpanzees and other great apes belong in zoos, because most zoos are not big enough and wealthy enough to be able to really build a facility that is spacious enough and enriching enough for these animals. We put them in enclosures, and even though their cognitive abilities overlap with that of our own, of course, we put them in enclosures we would never consider putting a human being into. So there are a lot of thorny ethical questions involving great apes that I think as time goes on, as the 21st century goes on, we're realizing that they just do not make appropriate captive animals in any context.
The great ape populations are declining, while the threats to them are mounting. Their survival appears impossible, but Stanford offers hope.
Well, I really do think that we're going through a bottleneck right now. Just as North America went through a bottleneck in the 1800s, where we nearly lost a lot of our big animals, the bison, the wolf, and so forth, and we managed to just get through with enough of those animals to repopulate national park areas and sanctuaries. So today we have, you know, relatively healthy populations of some of those big species. I'd like to think that great apes are in the same situation, and what we really need to do is ensure that over the next 50 to 100 years that Africa and Asia develop in a way that leaves room for some populations of wild great apes in truly wild areas that are well protected. And I really do think that's possible. It all has to do with economic development in Africa and Asia and changing attitudes toward wildlife. And what people can do, what listeners can do, they can be aware and they can raise consciousness of other people. There are many organizations out there that money can be donated to, the African Wildlife Foundation, the Jane Goodall Institute. And I often tell young people that, you know, you don't need a PhD to get involved in conservation work. If you can afford to volunteer your time, you can get involved in conservation work here in the U.S., but even in developing countries where primates, including apes, live, and be part of grassroots movements.
And do you have any upcoming plans or projects?
A lot of my work these days involves my graduate students who are doing work in Africa on chimpanzee research topics. Some of those are pure research, trying to understand what these animals are all about still. I have students who are doing very conservation-oriented work, trying to understand, for instance, how forest fragmentation, deforestation affects chimpanzees, which often continue to live in areas that are now largely farmland, and they come into conflict with people. and try to understand how does this affect their society, what's the interaction between people and chimps. So I'm involved in all these projects, and I'm also involved in conservation efforts with a whole range of other kinds of animals that are not great apes.
And what organizations do you recommend listeners to look to in order to try and get involved somehow?
I always recommend people get involved with and try to follow the activities of the Jane Goodall Institute, JGI. I mean, Jane Goodall is, as everybody knows, I think, still a very active force in the conservation world. She's become something of a Mother Teresa for the global environmental issues that are going on in the 21st century. And she has a nonprofit institute that is a very worthy cause for people to be following and to be donating to. There are many others. There are grassroots organizations all across Africa. The African Wildlife Foundation is a good one that people can find easily on the Internet and donate to.
That was primatologist Craig Stanford, author of Planet Without Apes. Science Questions is produced by Sherry Quinn, Elaine Taylor, and Susie Montgomery. Thank you for listening.
Aren't so bright.